wings in terms of how they move and how insects propel themselves and how they do that without making any sound, then we've got all sorts of opportunities to develop some really exciting technologies.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Beer with an Engineer, a podcast dedicated to shining a light and sharing a beer with the wonderful engineers who are creating the world around us. Time to grab a drink and get comfortable as your hosts lift the lid on what it's like to be an engineer in our current society. Now for your hosts, Mel and Dom DeJoya.
Hi, and welcome to episode 24 of Beer with an Engineer. Today's episode is going to give you some serious insight into some hardcore engineering. Right now, I'm going to ask you to hold tight for just a couple of seconds, because first I wanted to remind you of our website, www.beerwithanengineer.com.au. If you are an engineer, we would love to talk to you. Any type of engineer, it doesn't matter, just pop on over to our Be Our Guest page and sign up and I will be in contact with you. There's some really great perks about being on our show besides talking to Dom and I. I'm not going to talk much else because Christmas is coming and all our gift is done. So if you want to just go and check up episode 22 again and just relive the glory that was that episode, I would definitely recommend you do that. But now down to some serious business, I'd like to continue my unverified claim that we are the only podcast that has a drinking game. Either any time Dom says, or so, or I say, or so now.
Oh, you're expanding your drinking game now.
Yeah, I've expanded.
It's, and so. Okay.
Yeah, because I've heard one episode where I was umming my little heart out. So anytime Dom or I say, or so, have a drink. And then I'm going to ask you at the end of the episode to go over to iTunes and leave us a review, because I'd love to hear it. We don't make you drink beer. I drink cider. Our guest tonight is drinking a fat yak, but you can drink a wine, a tea, a coffee, a water, whatever you got on hand. So let's get cracking.
So joining us is Dr. Ben Hawken. Ben is a mechanical engineer who graduated from Loughborough University with a PhD. His resume reads like a dream list for a lot of people out there, myself included. So some of the work that he's done includes working for Ilmor Engineering, who act as consultants for motorsport clients, working for LMS UK, which acts as an engineering partner for the automotive, aerospace and manufacturing industries, working for Augusta Westland, which is an Anglo-Italian helicopter company, working at Loughborough University, conducting testing for cricket helmets, amongst other things, and now as a senior lecturer at UTS, working on noise and vibration research. Right, where do we start? Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. How are you?
No worries. Thanks. I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
Good.
Very good. I am slightly terrified about how technical you are, but we will definitely get to that.
That's okay. I just want to find out about all these automotive, helicopter and motorsport stuff. But
you'll have to make
it
sure.
It all sounds very grand, but it's just, a bit of engineering, really.
So that is it.
Been lucky.
At the end of the day, that's all it is. It's just a bit of engineering that, you know, shapes our society and molds our future. So, yeah. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're not just an engineer.
No. So I'm a farmer's son. I'm just over 41 years old. I have recently arrived in the country, end of 2016, so we're just approaching our two-year anniversary. Married with two children. Imogen, who's 4.5, and Elijah, who's 10 months today, in fact.
It's
been quite a year for us. We secured our permanent residency visas earlier this year. We're just in the process of buying a property in Warunga. So, it's been a pretty busy time. The last 2 years have been fairly full on.
Yeah, you look very well rested for someone with a 10-month-old, may I say.
He's just started sleeping through the night from 6 till 6, which has been absolutely brilliant. My wife went back to work last Monday, and on the Friday of that weekend, he did 12 hours straight through, and he's pretty much been it ever since. So it was perfectly timed, and, he's just been brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, our youngest, he started sleeping through at 9 months, the day before we went away on a holiday. And it was just, like the stars knew, everything aligned. It was brilliant. But what made you move to Australia just quickly?
That's a bit of a long story, but my wife essentially was invited to apply for a position out here with her employer, Philips Healthcare, a former boss in the UK that she'd worked for a number of years, did the move out here perhaps a couple of years before. When we were expecting Imogen, he invited her to apply, but the timing wasn't right. And he got in touch again a few years later, and the timing was better, so we went for it, and here we are.
And you're happy here?
Absolutely, yeah, delighted, really, really pleased. It's a great, you know, we're in a great part of the world. It's fantastic. You just have a weekend like we've just had weather-wise. And,
yeah,
it is beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful. You know, we've got jacaranda in bloom, and you know, we're on the harbour. It couldn't be a lot better. You have to pinch yourself actually every now and again to remind yourself. You know, it's easy to get bogged down with the day to day, grind and forget that we're all actually really lucky to be here. So
So whereabouts are you currently working?
So currently working at UTS.
UTS, and so you're a senior lecturer there.
So I'm senior lecturer and deputy head of school teaching and learning in the Mechanical and Mechatronic Engineering School, which is part of the Faculty of Engineering and IT, which is the new building. Well, it's no longer so new, but the building that most people will be familiar with that's on the corner of Wattle Street and Broadway, the big, you know, stainless steel clad structure that's got the green lights embedded within it such that in the evening, you know, you can just see this rather futuristic looking, flagship facility, which has been absolutely terrific.
Oh, so I've been there. That's the faculty, that building.
Yeah, it's a faculty. I used to UTS is where I went to university, and it was the lovely old engineering building that hung off the side of the tower building, which yeah, it was pretty old when I was there, and that was quite a long time ago myself. So I think you're in much nicer digs.
So that would be building two, I think, as it was referred to, and now that was demolished some years ago, and now we have UTS Central to replacing that, which is up to over 20 floors. I think it's approaching something like that. So it's like a phoenix, if you like, re-rising, and that's pretty impressive facility with some of the, you know, the latest technologies, including library retrieval system, automatic library effectively robot. Retrieval system, huge open plan project learning spaces, and it's going to be really really phenomenally exciting place to be.
So have you been there for 2 years now, or
So I've actually only just had my first anniversary in September. When we arrived, I initially looked after Imogen for a couple of months while Victoria was getting into a position, and we were getting childcare organised and so on. And then I took a position actually with a local scientific instrument distributor, which was terrific. They was Wasash Scientific in Redfern represent a number of US, European, some Far Eastern engineering and scientific instrument suppliers here in Australia, and have been importing such instrumentation and systems to the country for decades, since 1976, in fact. And I had a connection through my work at Loughborough with a supplier of a certain type of instrumentation in the UK. And when I mentioned that I was leaving the country to come to Australia, they offered to make a connection for me, which they duly did. And I reached out to the guys at Wasash when I arrived, and they very generously took me on. And I, at the time, told them that, look, you know, probably I'm looking to resume my academic career, but at that moment in time, I'd wound everything up that I'd been doing in the UK previously in terms of my academic career, and I was open-minded as to whether I pursued the remainder of my career in industry, or I looked to go back into academia. And in the end, a position came up at UTS, and I went for it, and they were really understanding. And since then, we've gone to do some good work together, some good projects. So I think it was a win-win for everybody, to be honest.
Yeah, great.
Feelings, and so that's, So I've just been there since, like I say, September last year.
And so you're not a novice to lecturing. What would you find is a satisfying part of being a lecturer, especially in the in universities and in the engineering space?
Well, it's great to see the development of young people, actually. And that sounds a bit corny, but it really is great to have an opportunity to influence young people and to see them develop, as engineers from arriving into the university at a relatively young age, having perhaps never been away from home. It's a little bit of a different dynamic in this country with respect to engineering undergraduates. at the previous institution in the UK, they would effectively leave home and come and stay at the university. Mm. Here it's a bit more of a daily commute for many of our undergraduates, and many of our undergraduates indeed have got full-time jobs and so on. Slightly different scenario, but nevertheless, they're relatively young people, and one of the great benefits one of the great opportunities is to help those young people shape their careers, but also to have the opportunity to engage in world-leading, challenging research, which is aimed to solve interesting national and international challenges, developing new technologies and applying those technologies and working with, you know, some of the great minds to do that. So
you get access to that by being in this university space, don't you?
Yeah.
No two days are different, and that presents some challenges in one way, but in other ways, you know, it makes for a really rich and vibrant and interesting career. And you can see from the sorts of projects I've been involved with from my career that, you know, there's a great variety. And that's one of the, I think, that one of the opportunities that you have pursuing a career in academia is essentially that you can do what you like. As long as you bring in research grant income, you write journal articles, you graduate PhD students, and you deliver undergraduate teaching, so teaching and learning. So that, you know, if you tick those four things off, you know, you pretty much have free rein to pursue whatever interests you, within reason.
Well, I think that's one of the things that people forget about, is that universities aren't just about going, you know, learning a degree or getting a degree. There is all of that research and the training that goes in behind it, where that was always, for industry, it was always the first port of call, that if there was something that you needed to find out, you go to the universities and they would do the heavy lifting for you. Because I remember when I was at UTS, I used to spend a bit of time in the labs with a gent by the name of Alex, and he was a wealth of knowledge, because of over his time at working at UTS, there was just about any project, every project under the sun that he was involved in. And, you know, with every couple of weeks, there'd be a new test rig and a new project that was being set up. And when they'd run through things and tell you about the things that they were learning and the things that they were discovering, these are things that were going to take years and years and years before they hit industry. So and all this knowledge was already there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is cutting edge. Yeah. So, but why did you get into engineering in the first place?
So I mentioned I'm a farmer's son, and so
it's a bit of a leap from a farm.
Yeah.
Well, it isn't in some ways. So I mean, on a farm you have a lot of equipment, and you need to do a lot of maintenance on that equipment, and so my dad, to his credit, essentially, I guess is maybe the right way to put it, wasn't the best mechanically minded individual. So I think, you know, from an early age, I was interested to look after the equipment, and he let me get into it, get into some projects, you know, rebuilding ploughs, keeping tractors running, things of this nature. That was probably where I, you know, found my passion for engineering. I wasn't particularly inspired to follow him into the farming business. My grandfather was a butcher. That's my mum's father, and her brother, they were both butchers, and they were keen on motorbikes. So when I was 6 or 7 maybe years old, I think Grandpa Kirk bought me this motorbike, and my uncle rebuilt it, a little Yamaha TY80 trial bike, which was a perfect little bike to have on the farm. And some of the early projects I did in engineering were essentially revolved around rebuilding 2-stroke motorcycle engines. So I got into quite heavily. And that was pretty fascinating. Yeah.
That's cool.
It's a good segue into working in the motor industry and working with mechanical equipment.
Yeah, it's a great learning ground.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did you ever pull anything apart of your dad's and not be able to put it back together?
I did actually. Well, I did pull apart a ride-on garden tractor, ride-on lawnmower, that was already broken, but I couldn't figure it out. And at one point, I had 7 motorcycles in the garage, which was a bit ridiculous. I just kept inheriting bikes from people that didn't want them anymore. They didn't they didn't work, and there were a couple that I was just not able to get going again. They weren't running for some reason or another. They stumped my engineering know-how at that moment, so they ended up getting scrapped off.
And so what was the very first project that you worked on as an engineer? Have you actually been out in industry as an engineer?
Yes, as a professional engineer, yes. Mm. So the first project that I was involved in would have, like, as a professional engineer, was when I did my work placement. You guys refer to them as internships here, and I did, in the UK, we would do a 12-month internship rather than 2 6-month internships. So I was really fortunate to have 12 months at JCB on designing diggers.
What's JCB?
They're a company that produces large mining and agricultural equipment.
Oh.
So diggers and...
Like a Caterpillar, yeah, but with probably smaller equipment than Caterpillar. So the sorts of equipment that you see doing roadside works and sort of smaller construction projects, let's say the mining. They do a lot of stuff for farms as well. So there's fast tractors that they've developed more recently that do like sort of 50, 60 kilometer hour tractors for hauling corn and things like this around. So
perfect for a farmer's son.
Oh, yeah. It was a perfect. I mean, I was absolutely delighted to get offered that position as a 19, 20 year old or something like that. Spent 12 months in Staffordshire, which is where JCB was founded, working at one of the satellite businesses called Special Projects, which, you know, as you can imagine by the name, did everything that was kind of special, new projects. And so one of the projects that I worked in, I did a rotation, four 3-month projects, spent some time in the welding shop, spent some time in the manufacturing production line, assembling wheeled excavators, wheeled loading shovels, and so I worked with a robot welding system in the manufacturing area. They asked me to develop some robot welding capabilities. That was pretty exciting because they were just introducing.
I was about to say, how long ago was that? Yeah. That was
just 1997-98. So it was kind of really quite in its infancy, the concept of robot welding. And so they had a lot of manual welding.
20 years ago.
And yeah, so they developed a range of equipment, so skid steer loader, that was made from lower gauge steel plate than the typical loading shovel type system. So, and this lower gauge steel plate could or was possible to be acquired with a better surface finish than the heavier gauge stuff. So the heavier gauge stuff would typically come in and it would be a bit rusty, and you could burn through the rust with a decent, you know, manual MIG welder. But the robotic welder needed the surfaces to be very clean prior to welding, and obviously also the gaps needed to be very precise and in the right position. So you would have fixtures and jigs and so on to put these frames together. But with a human welder, you can afford for there to be some differences from one system to the next. With a robot, it goes to the same location every time. And if the metal isn't where the robot goes, it welds there anyway. And so the large project, you know, trying to train the robot to be somewhat more intelligent about locating where the metal was before it started doing the welding. And so this was a project that I was involved with for a good period of time while I was at JCB.
Wow.
That was pretty exciting.
Yeah, to be involved in that sort of cutting edge technology at that age, what an amazing, you know, level of exposure for you. That's great. So what would you...
One of the great things, I suppose, about growing up in the UK with such a strong manufacturing sector and such sort of a, you know, like a cutting edge manufacturing sector, having an opportunity to go to top university in the UK to study where, you know, they were teaching like, you know, advanced topics and industry recognizing that the undergraduates and graduates were some of the best available in the UK. It's easy to kind of just take it for granted, like everything. I have had some really good opportunities in my career.
So what would you say is the most interesting job you've worked on in your career?
It's a really difficult choice. I've been really to work on some really great projects, but the one that everybody wants to know about is the Ilmor engineering position that I held for 3 years as a design and development engineer, developing racing engines for the Indy Racing League in the US, which is an one-wheeler racing car series that's, you know, everybody pretty much knows about the Indy 500 that's raced at the Indianapolis circuit, which they call the Brickyard once a year, and the series that goes with that, which is predominantly on oval circuits. And we developed a V8 engine that was badged Honda, and to work with some of the guys on that project that had so many years of experience developing engines, both for the IRL and for the Formula One series at Brixworth in Northamptonshire, was absolutely like a dream come true. I got that position immediately after completing my PhD at Loughborough, pretty much, and moved down there to Northamptonshire and made some really great friends who remain friends right until this day. And some of the work that they do,
the way that they
you know, treat the series, the professionalism, the way that they develop cutting edge technologies, you know, novel software algorithms that they develop in house, test procedures. It's a phenomenal activity and a great opportunity to have been involved with that. You know, you can pretty much get, you know, we could justify pretty much any manufacturing process that was available, any surface treatment technique that was, you know, revolutionary at the time. For example, diamond-like coating, which is a black surface finish that you would put to minimize the friction on a gudgeon pin in a racing engine, for example, just to try to make an extra small amount of horsepower that can be the difference between, you know, winning and finishing kind of halfway down the field. They were throwing all sorts of effort at that project. One weekend, one highlight for me particularly was having the opportunity to fly out to Detroit to our partner Ilmor Inc. That was a wholly owned subsidiary of Ilmor Engineering, based in Detroit, which is, you know, at the center of the automotive sector in the US, with a set of inlet manifolds that had been manufactured sort of earlier in that week that were going to be fitted to a car at the weekend for the race, because that was the most safe way was to send them. Just, I was basically a body to accompany these latest parts to be fitted to a vehicle, and then I didn't even get to stay for the race weekend. I was sent back on the flight on the Friday.
Besides being a courier, what was your actual role on the with the motors? Did you?
So the projects that I worked with on were, I mean, I was a junior engineer, so it wasn't as though, you know, I can't say that I was designing racing engines from scratch, but, you know, you can imagine that it's quite a, you know, there are a lot of engineers working on these projects. So I was involved with some top-end work. So I, for example, developed some spark plug plate hangers, move, you know, redesigning certain aspects of the engine on the top end, I would say, so like the cam side of the engine. I did work on a thermostat system for diverting oil. So when the cars initially go out, obviously the oil is slightly cooler than when it should be, like up at the prime operating temperature. So we developed a system for some of the teams that enabled the oil to remain within the engine. All production cars have this. This is not new from a production car, but it was something that hadn't really been looked at for racing engines. Typically, you know, the oil would just be deflated, and they're dry sumps, so the oil is scavenged out of the big end with a pump, essentially, and the air is separated from it in a centrifuge, and then there's a small tank, and then the oil goes back into the engine. But when it's cold, then clearly there's extra friction in the oil, and so you can potentially save, again, you know, or you can make a little bit of extra horsepower by leaving the oil in the engine for a little bit longer, so bypassing the tank, keeping the oil in, and then when it's up to temperature, moving it out. So I got to work on that project, developed some test rigs, developed some novel valves, tried to, you know, work. It was, the intention was that it needed to be a mechanical-only system, and that in itself presented some challenges. So it's relatively easy to come up with something that's electromechanical, but the specific brief was that this needed to be a fail-safe, mechanical-only system, and that's pretty tricky to develop something that's fail-safe, because if you get it wrong and the oil doesn't start to flow and it gets too hot, you light the engine up.
Yeah, it's pretty catastrophic.
You've got to get oil to the cooler when the time is right, and these valves, the systems that are used the wax stats are essentially the same technology that you have in your shower head, your shower control, you know, that essentially open up, and there's a load of hysteresis in them. So and they're all different, you know, they're manufactured in mass, you know, in mass production, slightly different amount of wax in each one, slightly different forming process. So deploying those in a racing engine scenario was, you know, pretty tricky to do. So
that you
was
were
quite an interesting project.
You were manufacturing the wax elements.
No, we were, more, we were buying
were from
we were buying
France. Were they coming out of France?
I think they perhaps were coming out of France, actually.
Yeah, because on the other side of it, for temperature control systems, like thermostats for heating and cooling systems, they and thermostat mixing valves that they use for temperature control, they all run on wax elements. And there's one company in France that pretty much manufactures all of them globally. So it's
I think you're right.
Almost as though they've got a market.
A small little brass thing with a little steel pin that moves up and down as the wax.
That's the one. Well, it's interesting though, the same thing that's in your showers running
Formula One car.
Running in
I'd like to say we developed we deployed it successfully, but to be honest, you know, it was a project that was worked on and it really never actually made it to deployment because we just couldn't predict the behavior of these things well enough. And it was too risky, you know, to put them in and to have to deal with this amount of hysteresis. And in the meantime, Toyota, we were so successful, Honda was so successful, that Toyota and Chevrolet, who were the other manufacturers in the series, they pulled out. And we basically, it became Indy Racing League, became a one engine series after I'd been with Ilmor for a couple of years. And then the business model changed. So rather than chasing performance, when you've only got to beat yourself, you don't need to, you know, every team's running a Honda engine. You don't need to, you know, pinch an extra 0.1 of, you know, power or whatever it is to win the race.
It comes down to the driver.
It comes down to, teams, I mean, the engine, the Indy Racing League, the cars are all primarily the same, unlike Formula One. And obviously when the engines are also all of the same, then it just starts to come much more down to the driver. The teams, the vehicle teams, they do have a little bit of influence, and it's about, it becomes about the knowledge. But as an engine manufacturer at that point, you're effectively just trying to minimize cost and optimize durability. So it changes the way the team operates. And I have to say, it became a little bit less interesting at that point. And then an opportunity presented itself, and I left there and joined LMS UK.
I have to say, I'm glad you've sort of moved on, because I reckon Dom can talk motorsports and because he got into mechanical engineering because he wanted to essentially do what you have done.
in essence, except with rally cars, with WRC. But unfortunately, in Australia, there's not a lot of options for motorsport.
And that's the beauty of Ben. He wasn't actually in Australia. So
no, that was it. And they actually, at UTS, in one of our first lectures, I think I'd said it in one of the earlier podcasts, where the lecturer said, hands up everyone who's here to, because they want to get into Formula One, building engines and cars. And a large proportion of the hands went up. And mine went up, even though I kind of want to do WRC. And the lecturer said, well, to start with, you're in the wrong course and you're in the wrong country. So you basically all need to be in the UK. Okay, that's a little bit tough.
That is a bit tough, yeah.
Yeah, true.
True. But nonetheless, ended up in mechanical engineering somewhere else and very happy with my my course. So I get to dabble occasionally in the motor racing side of things on the weekends. That's probably enough
that's
for
okay.
me.
So, okay, we'll move on.
Yeah, let's.
What would you see as a hot topic in the engineering community at the moment?
So for me, this is a personal hot topic. And it's aligned with my primary research interest at the moment, which is the non-contact measurement of surface vibration using laser Doppler vibrometry. And so my real passion with this technique is to be able to use this to do remote infrastructure condition monitoring. And that sounds like a lot of complicated words, but there really are a lot of opportunities, particularly in I think in Australia, where we have a lot of remote infrastructure, to be able to deploy this kind of technology to enable us to do or to understand better the dynamic characteristics of systems and structures that exist within our environment that we need to be able to maintain the condition of. I can expand on that if you wish.
I was just actually wondering if you could, I might need a practical application to understand.
Yeah. So the technology, so we know, I think we all as engineers or people that have got some interest in engineering understand what the Doppler effect is. You know, when a police car or an ambulance passes us on the street, as it comes towards us, the tone that the siren makes is increased in frequency as a result of the velocity of the vehicle. And as it passes us, we hear the actual frequency because there's no relative change, there's no relative velocity. And then when the vehicle has passed by us and is moving away from us, we see a decrease in velocity, in frequency as a result of the velocity of the vehicle. And so you can use this capability, this phenomenon, to measure surface vibration using a laser beam. And so when we project a coherent laser beam onto a surface and it vibrates, the frequency of the light that's backscattered from that surface is shifted as a result of the vibration, and it's proportional. So essentially, it's a function of the Doppler shift is simply a function of the wavelength of the light, which with a laser beam is a single wavelength. Red light is 633 nanometers, and the velocity. And so that's really convenient to be able to make a measurement using that technique, because if we are interested in measurements, for example, on light structures, such as insect wings, let's say, for example, or appendages of insects, then we can't attach a contacting transducer to those kinds of structures. So some really excellent research carried out in Australia. You know, okay, we don't necessarily have the most, buoyant manufacturing industry, and we've talked about how fortunate I was to be able to start my career in the UK with all the opportunities that go with that, but nevertheless we have some really exciting and cutting-edge world-leading research researchers and institutions within the country, and one area of particular interest is in autonomous systems, advanced manufacturing, robotics, micro robotics. And so if we can learn about the dynamics of insect appendages, for example, and insect wings in terms of how they move and how insects propel themselves and how they do that without making any sound, then we've got all sorts of opportunities to develop some really exciting technologies from a defense standpoint, and from an efficient manufacturing standpoint, small scale manufacturing, all sorts of interesting processes. And we can make those measurements using techniques such as laser Doppler vibrometry. So there's an example.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, so why are you measuring this? So basically you're wanting to understand something in the natural world so that you could replicate it in the built environment, or?
Yeah, that's one example. That's just one example of the kinds of things that you can do. There are some really, so in my job as a racing engine designer, we had one of these systems. It's not new. The technology is not new. It's pretty much been around since the advent of the laser, which is in the late 60s. It's really commercially now viable. The systems that are available are robust. They can be deployed in any kind of an engineering environment. And so we had a system at Ilmor Engineering, and we used it to measure the relative vibration of cams when they're closing. So when you have, a dynamic system, valves, when a valve closes, we have to develop the profile of the cam to optimize the rate at which the valve closes. And so ideally you get it to close quickly and stay closed, and then when it opens, you want it to open quickly and stay open. But there are lots of compromises that have to be made. You can't have something just stop instantaneously without high levels of acceleration, and high levels of acceleration lead to high levels of torque. So we would use one of these laser vibrometer systems with two beams, one to put one laser beam on the cylinder head, and the other laser beam would be on the valve itself. And so you can measure valve bounce. And this is, you're talking about something that's rotating potentially up to, in a Formula One scenario, 20,000 RPM. In the IRL scenario, we're talking about slightly lower engine RPMs, 10,300 RPMs. So even that's a pretty, you know, compared with a production engine, which is maybe 4,500 RPM, that's pretty fast. And so these valve closings happen pretty quickly and you get lots of energy and valve bounds. You know, we're talking about small velocity, relatively, well, large velocities, but small displacements, high frequencies. So these non-contact transducers are the only real viable way that you can do this in that kind of a scenario. And I've got a company currently using a system of mine, in fact, they're just sending it back to me, and they're using it for tuned condition monitoring of engine systems in gas compression stages up in Queensland, in country Queensland, where we're extracting, you know, raw materials. And we have to understand about the vibration, the torsional vibration of the engines, and they can do that instantaneously without connecting any transducers using a pair of laser beams. And so we're able to deploy these techniques in real world engineering scenarios, but we're also able to develop novel techniques, for example, to make measurements of systems that are hard to reach or in remote locations. You know, it might be that we want to, for example, make measurements of a wind turbine in an offshore wind farm. And of course, these systems are already fitted with instrumentation, but they, you know, sometimes a failure occurs or is about to occur, and you need to get a measurement device to that structure and make some novel, you know, some measurements that you hadn't planned on making. Anyway, I'm talking too much.
No, that's right. I'm you keep going. Because it's one of those things where I'm actually thinking about what you're saying, that and the applications, particularly in Australia, because it is such a vast land that I have a friend who manages pipeline systems, so the gas pipeline systems that run through Northern Territory down to South Australia. And by being able to set up those kind of systems where it's managing and assessing the condition, through real-time, those sorts of real-time assessments can mean that you can have things. Well, you can see when things are nearing the end of their life cycle without having to send someone into the middle of nowhere to try and have a look at it. So they're only going there when they're required, and it also gives them a decent amount of lead time, so they're not doing costly maintenance work when it's not required, but also doing it before it turns to a major catastrophe. So it's the implications are amazing, far-reaching.
There's still lots of wooden telegraph poles, for example. You guys don't call them telegraph poles, I don't suppose, but poles carrying electric cables.
Yeah, we do.
you call it
power poles.
I'm here now too, so you know, power poles. And so there have been plenty of examples, I understand, of these power poles becoming termite infested, and clearly then their structural integrity is reduced as a result of that termite infestation. And so potentially we can use like laser vibrometers mounted on unmanned aerial vehicles to do a survey in the field of all of these, you know, not necessarily all of them, but, you know, we can go out with a system and fly it to a location and measure the vibration response of a structure and attempt to determine the nature of its structural integrity. Does it have the same vibration signature as a good power pole, or is it potentially, has it undertaken some damage as a result of termites, and therefore it might need to, you know, it might be at risk of coming down and then causing, you know, huge fire or whatever as the electricity lines contact, you know, whatever it is that's underneath them. So
That non-destructive testing side of things as well just means that you're not weakening something that could be fine to determine whether or not it's fine, and then it was fine, and the next thing you know, you've kind of ruined it in the process of trying to work out if it's okay or not. So, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I can give you another example if you're interested. I'm working with a colleague in the Centre for Autonomous Systems at UTS, which is a really prestigious research centre that we have there, and we're interested in using these systems to do some selective harvesting. So it's an agricultural engineering application whereby you can determine the nature of ripeness, let's say, of a piece of fruit or vegetable based on its vibration signature. If we can mount these systems to field robots, they can potentially make their way around the orchard, interrogating the ripeness of fruit, and then selectively harvesting the fruit at the right moment when it's, you know, when it's reached perfect ripeness, as a, and we determine that based on its vibration signature. So those sorts of, I think, so what they're doing very well at the moment is vision-based selective harvesting, using camera-based technologies to, you know, look at the nature of the fruit, various other aspects that you can determine using essentially a camera, taking an image and processing that image. But potentially we can augment that by using that camera image to identify fruit that maybe we also want to point a laser beam at to make some vibration measurements to understand something about the response, the vibration response of that piece of fruit. So these are all hypothetical ideas, but there are applications. There have already been plenty of research projects on determining the ripeness of fruit using laser vibrometry. So it's, in some respects, it's not new, but having those systems mounted on field robots or autonomous vehicles and being able to do autonomous harvesting on a large scale is really quite exciting.
Mm, cutting edge. So what would you think the future of engineering looks like?
I think there's...
Any difference? Or?
I mean, the data is, you know, there's so much data nowadays. Mm-hmm. We've got sensors everywhere.
Collecting, you know, all the time, 24/7.
Collecting data. Data storage is becoming, you know, massive. Engineering is going to be, I think, a bit, you know, quite different in the future. You know, we're going to be needing to make decisions based on these mountains of data. I think that, you know, we're engineers are different animals these days, and I'm no different in some respects. You know, we don't tend to be the keepers of knowledge anymore. The internet's the keeper of knowledge, you know, and so if you need to find something out, you Google it. Even engineers use these tools. significantly, and so I think, you know, and that's about data and knowledge, and so topics like deep learning and artificial intelligence, these sorts of topics are going to be at the heart of the future of engineering, in my opinion.
Okay, and so what would you say to people just starting out?
It's a really exciting time to be starting out as a young engineer, because, you know, we're in the fourth industrial revolution, really. We're right in this, you know, well, are we at the start of industry four, as it's referred to, or are we already into it? We're definitely into it, but we don't know when it will end and when we'll be looking at industry five. So it's a really exciting time to be starting out as an engineer. It's, you know, some huge challenges. There's, you know, global challenges like clean water and food supply and fuel, energy. There's some really significant challenges, global warming, of course, as well, security. These are the sorts of global challenges that we now have, that young people starting out as engineers have got a great opportunity to help to try to solve some of these problems. I think it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, I love that. You're releasing, it's December when everyone's listening to right now, and you haven't even heard this, but Trish White is episode 20, and she speaks exactly about how, I think almost verbatim, very exciting time, and her topic was Industrial Revolution 4.0, so it's exactly what you were saying. Yeah. So, you haven't even heard her speak yet, so it's like you were channeling her. But it is. It's amazing how so many engineers we speak to say this is an exciting time. It's just beginning. All these changes.
But with where you're talking about data, it just, the amount of data is overwhelming these days. So I think one of the things is,
that's almost a hot topic.
Yeah, it's going to be. It's great that we have all this data, but how we use it and also how we sift through to determine what is relevant and what's irrelevant. Like, you know, it's almost as though we need to work out. We've now captured it all, but do we need it all?
I feel like one of those, like a bit OCD, in that we keep it. It's data.
Yeah, we've got to keep it.
Gotta keep it. But in actual fact, Like, how much do we really need to keep and what's really useful? And
when you catalog everything, then are you actually going to look at anything? It's
I think we've gone off slightly tangent.
There are probably, I'm sure there are statistics on this, things that ring a bell, are the fact that, you know, or maybe it's not a fact, but it's believable that we're creating more data a year now than has been created since, you know, time began.
That wouldn't surprise me.
It's like just the exponential growth of data is phenomenal. We have a school, a data engineering school at UTS now, and the data engineering school wasn't something that existed when I started as a young engineer. You know, there wasn't a course on data engineering.
There's a whole school on it.
Mushroomed in the last 20 years as a topic because we're responding to what society needs and the way engineering is heading. So,
So just more in that space, I suppose, in the future.
Mm.
So, is there a piece of engineering that impresses you?
It's difficult to look beyond, our iconic landmarks in the Sydney Harbour, right? You know, the Sydney Opera House and the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I mean, those pieces of engineering are phenomenally. I mean, the Harbour Bridge, they've got one in Newcastle upon Tyne, right? It's the same bridge, but it's not quite as impressive. No.
Are you saying that because it's right behind us? And for people out there listening, it's like we have a picture that I took at Taronga Zoo behind us. So you generally impressed by
the house. It's phenomenal. I mean, when it was developed and how they managed to realize that idea, without the kinds of technologies that we just take for granted now in terms of, finite element analysis, structural analysis, all of these things would have been done, the hard way in those days on paper, right? There were no models. There's no CAD model that was used to develop. And now we just expect, these things to be born in CAD and then to be realized. And so, what a terrific piece of engineering that is, just to achieve what was achieved there with those shapes and the geometry. That really impresses me.
Yeah, I think we read somewhere that it was 30,000 calculations.
I think it was a Financial Review.
It might have been in the Fin Review that there was an engineer
who did
30,000 calculations to make that building work.
In modern times, and he was 100% right.
Yeah, I think whilst he was doing it, there was a computer that was at one of the universities, I can't remember, and so they could only run the simulations at night, but they were checking his calculations. So we need to check into it.
Dom was amazed.
Oh, it's just astounding. And that's the thing, it was all done by slide rules and, on paper by hand. None of this... I'll just chuck that in my program and,
I'll write a program that'll calculate all that.
and to think that he was bang on to these tolerances that even today we're not building things with those sorts of tolerances is just amazing, absolutely amazing.
And to wrap up, is there an engineer that you admire, past or present?
I have to have a bit of a think about it. I was hoping that I was going to be able to claim the father of steam, Robert Stephenson, as a Yorkshireman, being that I'm a Yorkshireman. But unfortunately, he's from, just up the country a little bit in Tyne and Wear. But, I think that inspired me as a young person because obviously we were growing up in that part of the world and, his rocket steam engine that he developed, that was one of the things that really interested me as a young person growing up. So I think, those are different times. I'd go for Robert Stephenson.
Is that the same? Have we had him before?
I think Steve Wellman might have. Yeah. Understandable because he's such a... Oh, no, Steve did Brunel.
It's the trains. It's all the steam. Yeah. So I think we've had something like four Englishmen. You're number four on the show, and every single one of them has been steam engine.
Well, it kickstarted the industrial revolution. So it's
without that, we wouldn't have We just wouldn't have had an industrial revolution. We wouldn't have been able to transport goods from one location to another. And, you know, with the efficiency that, that was realized through the development of the steam engine. And he tried and tried and tried and eventually succeeded. So, I mean, he had a resilience as well that makes him admirable as a character.
I think that's a big thing with engineering as well. It's just first time, it's pretty rare the first time works. So it's just a matter of going and going again.
But I try to tell young people that I'm involved with at UTS that you learn more when things don't go perfectly the first time.
Yeah.
And that's difficult for young people to really appreciate that, like, you know, learning is about understanding why things don't work. You get much more out of that than you do if things work first time every time. And that's difficult to manage in education because, you know, ideally you want to set a laboratory exercise that is predictable. You know what the students are going to do. You get to the end and you know, so you can fit it within a certain time block and you can schedule it, timetable it. You know what the outcome will be, so you can assess it effectively and all of the rest of it. And that, like, really contradicts what a practicing engineer will find in their career, in that they'll be effectively proving things that not to work more often than proving things to work.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's, I think that's a great way to
end on.
So a bit of advice again for people just starting out. I love that. You learn more when things don't go perfectly. So stays in there. So thanks. Thank you so much, Ben, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Great.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Beer with an Engineer. Hopefully you're not too tipsy from all the ums and sos, but either way, now is the best time to give us a review. We would love to hear what you think about our podcast series, and pop on over to iTunes and leave us a little note, and we will definitely be listening or watching for it. You can find further information on today's show on our website with the show notes. Again, it's www.beerwithanengineer.com.au. And if you're an engineer, go and check out our Be Our Guest sign-up page because we'd love to talk to you. And as you know, beer doesn't grow on trees, so we would love some money as well. Go check out our sponsorship page while you're there. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We're all over it. And you can see what we talk about and who we're talking to each week. We release every Friday a new podcast with a fascinating engineer. Thank you again for listening. We hope you enjoyed this and we look forward to you joining us next week when we bring you another interview with one of our engineering champions.